When I was moving from the first grade into the second grade, during that summer, I had some friends who had just finished the second grade and had the teacher that I was expected to have. And I remember them warning me, Madame Crevier is very strict. She is a very hard teacher. And there was, I find it hard to even describe the kind of fear and discomfort I had thinking about going into the second grade, knowing that my second grade teacher had the reputation of being strict. Like what was it about that as a child I'm just afraid of any teacher that's going to be severe or fair or have consequences? It's interesting that fear develops because as I went through school and even in Bible college, I found that the professors that I had that were the strictest, that were, you know, the most severe in their consequences, but fair in how they made those decisions, I probably learned the most from. In fact, one professor I can think of that taught Old Testament and Hebrew and things like that, he was strict, he was fair, the consequences were severe, but I learned a ton from him. I think as people, and I definitely did as a kid, we have this sense of discomfort, of fear when there are consequences. It makes us uncomfortable. It makes us uncomfortable to think that someone would actually follow through with punishment, with the threat of whatever happens if we don't follow the rules. We don't talk a lot about the wrath or judgment of God. And that can be either good or bad, depending on your perspective. Maybe you want more fire and brimstone preaching, or maybe you have been through churches where that's been the case, and you're just tired of that being the thing that is always hit on. But sometimes we just don't address the issue, and it's something that we brought up a bit last week as we were talking about the prophets. It was hinted at as we learned that the prophets had messages about pointing people back to God, telling Israel and Judah, turn back to God or there will be consequences to pay. God will judge you. He will have consequences for you if you don't turn back. But it makes us uncomfortable. Why can't God just be nice about it? Why can't he just, you know, forgive everybody? It seems to be something that we're going to encounter quite a bit as we move through these next few chapters of the story. But we need to understand it. We need to tackle the subject. We can't pass it over. Because when we don't talk about it, when we don't learn through it or think about it in the right way, we can come to weird conclusions. We can come to a place where maybe we start to believe that, well, God in the Old Testament is the wrathful, angry, judging God. But once we get to the New Testament, everything's good and happy, and that's where God is the nice guy. So we stay away from the Old Testament because that's where God is angry. And we only spend our time in the New Testament. We need to understand how God's wrath and judgment fits in with his love and mercy. Because if we don't have a full picture of what God is like. And we're probably not worshiping God for who he is if we don't understand both sides of that coin. This week in the story, as we move through the whole story of God as recorded in the Bible, we're in chapter 6 of the book, but we're in a part of Israel and Judah's history where the chapter is called the beginning of the end. It's called the beginning of the end because for years, God has been trying to get Israel and Judah's attention. The people of God split into two kingdoms, both having moments where they're far from God, Judah sometimes being good and faithful, following God. But God has been trying to get their attention, and he sent prophets for years and years trying to get people's attention. We used the analogy last week of God using prophets like an alarm clock, trying to wake Israel up from their sleep, from their apathy, from not caring about what God thinks. But time after time, instead of waking up, they just hit the snooze button and rolled over for another 9 minutes until the next alarm went off. But we see that God told them through the prophets, if you don't listen, if you don't wake up, if you don't turn back to me in obedience and justice, there will be consequences. In our story this week, we learn about a king in the northern kingdom of Israel named Hoshea. And he was not a great guy. He was not a king who loved God. In fact, he allowed for the worship of other gods all around the place. He set up places of worship for them. He didn't obey the laws of God, so he was leading Israel further and further away from God. And something we need to understand at this time is there was a big superpower at play in the world. Remember how in the Exodus, back several chapters ago, Egypt was like the superpower of the world at the time. They were the empire that dictated what went on. Now, in Hoshea's time, Assyria is that superpower. And they were the big empire that ruled and bullied the Middle East to get what they wanted. They had an army. They had terrible things that they would do to people they conquered in order to strike fear. And so what they would do is they would threaten different kingdoms, and in order for them not to destroy the kingdom, they would draw tribute from them all the time. That these kingdoms, including Israel and Judah, would pay tribute to Assyria so that Assyria wouldn't come and destroy them. But one day, Hoshea decides, we're not going to pay tribute to Assyria anymore. What we're going to do is, instead, we're going to use that money to hire Egypt as kind of a backup army to come and protect us in case Assyria actually comes and threatens us. They were trying to call Assyria's bluff. But what we learn, this backfires on him, and Assyria comes in, and they totally destroy the northern kingdom. They pillage the capital of Samaria. They take over all the land. They put Hoshea in prison. And they deport 27,000 Israelites from the northern kingdom to other parts of the empire of Assyria. This was one of their many tactics in order to wipe out a people so that they wouldn't have a culture, they wouldn't have a religion, they wouldn't have an identity. They would take them out of their homeland. They would ship them to all different parts of their empire. And they would move in Assyrians into the territory so that it was no longer the kingdom of Israel. It was just another part of the empire of the Assyrians. And it no longer existed as the kingdom of Israel. They were destroyed by the Assyrians. But what's interesting, in the midst of this horror, in these terrible things that Assyria does to the kingdom of Israel, we read why it happened. In 2 Kings 17, or on page 219 in your storybook, this is what it says about the Assyrians destroying Israel. It says, "All this took place because the Israelites sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods. They did wicked things that aroused the Lord's anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, 'You shall not do this.' The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, 'Turn from your evil ways. Observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey and that I delivered to you through my servants and the prophets.'" Assyria coming in and destroying the northern kingdom wasn't just Assyria being greedy, but was actually God's way of bringing his judgment on Israel for not listening to the prophets, for not turning back to God, and for persisting in their sin. God isn't the kind of God who makes threats and then doesn't follow through with them. There are consequences to sin. A few years later, something similar happens in the southern kingdom of Judah, where there's a king on the throne whose name is Hezekiah. And what we learn about Hezekiah, he was a pretty good guy. He was a pretty solid king. He wanted to follow God with all of who he was. And he has the Assyrians now on his doorstep. And he decides to not pay the tribute, just like the northern kingdom did. And so Assyria comes knocking. They come threatening. They send angry letters. And this is what they say. They say, don't tell me you're going to be stupid like the Israelites. And you're going to use your money and trust in Egypt to come and protect you. Because Egypt's not coming. Egypt didn't come for Israel. But then they go even further and they say, and please don't tell me you're trusting in your God to save you. Your God is not going to protect you. He's not going to save you from the mighty power of Assyria. We've conquered all these other territories and none of their gods protected them. Your God is not going to protect you. And in a scare tactic, messengers come and they even speak in Hebrew so all of them can understand. They say, don't listen to Hezekiah. Don't listen to him when he's trusting in God because your God's not going to be there for you. And so Hezekiah naturally is terrified by these threats. He's seen the devastation that Assyria brought to the northern kingdom. But what we see in Hezekiah's response says a lot about him. What he does is he runs to the temple and prays. He consults with the prophet Isaiah, who was God's prophet speaking to Judah at the time. And this is what Hezekiah says in 2 Kings 19, verses 15 and onward. This is on page 222 in your storybook. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord. He said, Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Give ear, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Listen to the words that Sennacherib has said to ridicule the living God. It is true, Lord, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste to these nations and their lands. They have thrown their gods into the fire and destroyed them, for they were not gods, but only wood and stone fashioned by human hand. Now, Lord, our God, deliver us from his hand, so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone, Lord, are God. We see Hezekiah coming to God, trusting in God, regardless of what the threats of the Assyrians were. And Isaiah the prophet speaks on behalf of God and encourages him. He says, listen, God is going to come through for you. And we read further down in verse 35, God does come through. And he brings out his judgment, not on Judah, but on the army of the Assyrians. This is what it says in verse 35. That night the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. And one day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god, Nisroch, his son Adrammelech and Sherezer killed him with the sword. They escaped to the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, succeeded him as king. Now, when we read this, we see God's judgment come down, not on Judah, but on the Assyrian army. We see this act of God's miraculous saving power almost in a way that would make the readers of this think of how God delivered them from Egypt. We can't underplay the significance of this moment. This is another Egypt moment for God's people, where the superpower of the world was there ready to destroy them. But God shows himself bigger and better and more powerful than even the strongest kingdoms on earth. But as we read this, no doubt there's a question in your mind, and it occurs to me too, why is it that God acts so differently here? Why is it that God allows Assyria to come in and destroy the northern kingdom and deport thousands of their people, using them in slavery and hard labor? But then God comes through for the southern kingdom, and instead of using Assyria as his rod of justice, he brings justice on the Assyrians. Why does he show wrath to one and grace to another? Is God just lashing out on the northern guys because he doesn't like them? Is God playing favorites? It doesn't seem fair. And you might think this doesn't make God look very good. So how do we make sense of this discrepancy we see? Well, in the chapter that we have this week, there's quite a bit of writing from the prophet Isaiah, the prophet that Hezekiah consulted when the Assyrians were on his doorstep. And Isaiah has two clear pictures of God that he brings forward in his writings. In this chapter, we see writings from Isaiah 6 and also from Isaiah 53. Two clear pictures Isaiah has of God. And both of them help us understand both the side of wrath and judgment that God has and God's love, mercy, and grace on the other side. The first picture is in Isaiah chapter 6. And this is the moment where Isaiah really comes to know God and be called by God as a prophet. This is what he says. In the year that King Uzziah died, who was a king of Judah, I saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were the seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling one to another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." And at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. This vision that Isaiah has is one of God seated on his throne, the perfect king, the perfect judge on his throne as the ruler of the cosmos. And as we continue to read, Isaiah, probably one of the holiest men on earth at this time, in the presence of God, falls down on his face and says, "Woe is me. I am unworthy to be in the presence of God. I should die by being so close to God because God is so holy." Even the seraphim, these angelic creatures that are flying around the throne of God, they have to cover their faces because of the holiness and majesty of God. Isaiah is saying here that I am not worthy to be in the presence of God because of my sin. A perfect and holy God will judge sin. When a holy God and sinful people come and collide in one place, one is destroyed, and it's not going to be the holy God, because sin and holiness cannot be together. A perfect and holy God, like the one we see in Isaiah chapter 6, will rightly judge sin because that is the right and holy thing to do. His wrath towards the sin of rebellious humans is the perfect response of a perfect God to sin. When we think of the judgment and wrath of God, it makes us uncomfortable. I see many of you, you're uncomfortable now with this idea, because we don't like the thought of God being able to come in and punish us for our sin. It scares us. And it causes us either to be in fear or to dismiss God's call of judgment why can't God just be nice? Why can't he just overlook all this sin? But when we think of the wrath and judgment of God, God's wrath is not like a drunken boyfriend coming in and beating his girlfriend just because he's stronger and can. God's wrath and judgment is like a well-trained and just courtroom judge who hands out the perfect sentence for the crime committed. If you've been following the news this past week, there's been a man on trial, actually from Haley's hometown in Michigan, who was a doctor for the U.S. national gymnastics team. And he traveled with the Olympic teams in gymnastics for the U.S. And he would treat women and girls, but many of his treatments was actually abuse. And he was sexually abusing these women and girls. Over 150 women and girls abused over his career. He's also on charges of child pornography, so that's a whole other issue. But in his trial for his abuse, as woman after woman comes forward, who were merely girls at the time when this happened, there's this sense within all of us that wants to see judgment come down hard on this man for his crime, for his sin. And the judge, Rosemary Aquilina, who brought the sentence on this man, she said in her sentencing, "It is my privilege to sentence you to 175 years. You will never get parole." In fact, she says, "I'm signing your death warrant." And there's this sense of relief that we have when we hear those things. When judgment and justice come down heavy and hard where it should be applied, we have a sense of relief that justice is being served. "It is my privilege to sentence you to 175 years. We long for that kind of justice to come about. If she had given him a few months in jail, there would be outrage. We would be totally disgusted by the lack of justice. Isaiah shows us in Isaiah 6 this holy, perfect God sitting on his throne who will bring down the right, heavy sentence on sin. So much so that Isaiah feels unworthy to be in his presence. But there's another picture that Isaiah brings us. In Isaiah chapter 53, page 228 of your storybook, if you're following along this way. And I'm just going to read some excerpts from Isaiah 53. It says this about the suffering servant. "He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us turned from our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life offering for sin, he will see his offering and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand." The picture that Isaiah shows us in Isaiah 53 is not God on his throne, but is of a man beaten up and bloodied. A man who is being judged and sentenced for sin, being beaten and executed. But what we learn is that this man is not being beaten and killed for his own sin. He is beaten and accused and sentenced for the sin and iniquity of others. This prophecy of Isaiah, 500 years before Christ, foretells Jesus, God in the flesh who would come. And though he lived a perfect life, was totally innocent, he was crushed and punished. He received the wrath and judgment of God for the sake of others. Like we sang in that song, on the cross as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. God the Son comes in the flesh, lives a perfectly obedient life. An obedience that would put Hezekiah and Isaiah to shame. Jesus comes into the world in the flesh and is bloodied. He himself takes the wrath and suffers and dies on the cross for us. Receives the wrath of God to the point where he prays to the Father and says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But here's the deal. That on the cross, Christ has taken the judgment onto himself for anyone who would believe and trust in him for forgiveness. The cross of Jesus, which is predicted in Isaiah 53, is an instance in history where we see both the wrath and judgment of God and the love and mercy of God overlap in one event. Where God's judgment towards sin is placed on Christ so that his love and mercy can abound for you and I who trust in him. God's wrath and love have to be understood for us to really comprehend God, for us to truly understand the good news of the gospel. So that anyone who, like Hezekiah, in the face of the judgment of Assyria, who goes to God and trusts him, whoever humbles himself before his mercy will receive it. Yes, God will bring judgment on sin, and he will be fair, like a good courtroom judge brings the proper sentence. And for your sin and for my sin, we will one day be in the divine courtroom, so to speak, and we will have to face that sentence. But yes, there is grace and mercy because of Christ. That for those of us who we live to repent and trust Christ, when our genuine faith in Christ brings us to a place where we trust him and follow him, we won't be sentenced for our sin. That the sentence has already been paid. Time has already been served. Christ has already borne our judgment on the cross. He has endured what we deserve. So as we look at this story of the northern kingdom destroyed, and the southern kingdom saved by God's mercy, we're called to reflect on it. We're called to think about it in the context of our own life. Am I going to be like King Hosea in the north, who doesn't take the warnings of God's judgment seriously? That, oh, God's judgment, that they talk about. It's all fire and brimstone. It's not fair. It's not true. God isn't actually like that. So we don't take it seriously or listen to it. And as a result, end up facing the very judgment we mock. Or will we be like Hezekiah in the south, that in the face of the Assyrians humbled himself and ran to God for mercy? Will we humble ourselves and run to Christ who took our Assyrian siege for us? Will we be people who are about trusting that God has paid our sentence through Christ. And for those of us who we've made that decision long ago, I think the really relevant question for us, as those who really have received that graceful gift of God, are our lives about living that gift to the fullest? Are our lives about living for God in a way that shows I have been freed?